All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. What's happening? Is everything all right? Are you all right? Is it okay? Are you underwater? Are you on fire? Is it too windy for you to stand on your porch? What's happening? Where are we at? Is it raining ash yet? I'll tell you, it's been kind of nice out here in Los Angeles the last few days. I don't know if I've talked to you. When did I last talk to you? I went to New Mexico. I don't think I've talked to you since I've been there. I had an okay time. It's weird going home. I looked at some property. I thought maybe I should go home for good, or at least spend some time there. But I don't know. I don't know if I want to live up in the mountains in northern New Mexico. I don't know if that's me. As my producer, Brendan McDonald, said when I showed him pictures of it, he said, this is for you? You're going to live there? And I'm like, maybe I could spend every few weeks or every month or so, I could go out there for a few days. He said, you, the guy who during quarantine for 10 days was texting me like he was the Omega Man? All right, I get it. That doesn't mean I can't change, right? Look, I have Mira Sorvino on the show today. And I just want to mention, obviously, I mean, many of you know her. She's an Academy Award winner for her performance in Mighty Aphrodite. She was in Guillermo del Toro's Mimic, Spike Lee's Summer of Sam. She was recently in Ryan Murphy's Netflix series, Hollywood. And she's in the new Starz series, Shining Veil, with Courtney Cox and Greg Kinnear. But it's heavy, man. You know, she had a big chunk of her career taken from her by Harvey Weinstein. Directors like Peter Jackson have admitted they were told by Weinstein not to cast her in projects years after she had endured sexual harassment by the pig and rejected his advances, Weinstein. It's heavy, man. This took a big toll on her, and she's a great actress. But I'm here to tell you it's all still very raw and difficult for Mira, and we talk about it. We talk about all of it. And I just want to make sure that you know what's coming ahead of time here. It's emotional stuff. On a lighter note, I had a couple of nice things happen this week. Let me tell you about New Mexico. I saw my dad. He's holding steady not a lot of change. It's good to see him. I'm glad to be there for him. I'm happy to be part of this process as he sort of... He's now all of a sudden listening to my podcast. So he used to be on it without knowing it, but now he's sort of, I think his wife, Rosie, has got him finally figured out how to hear me. But I'm glad I'm going out there and showing up and taking him out for lunch and sitting around watching him fall asleep on the couch while we watch a movie. That kind of stuff, you know, regular dad-son stuff. You all right, Dad? You all right? Just want to say that if he's listening, I love you. It was good to see you. And I'll be back soon. I'm going to keep coming until you forget who I am. Then you're on your own. Is that a deal? Can we make that deal? I'll be at Largo tonight, 8:30 p.m. here in Los Angeles. On Saturday, I'll be in San Luis Obispo, California at the Fremont. That's March 5th at 7 o'clock p.m. A few tickets left. I'll be in Santa Barbara, California on Sunday, March 6th. At 7:30 p.m. at the Lobero. And then next week, a lot of stuff in the East Coast. New Haven, Connecticut, March 9th at College Street. Music Hall in Troy, New York on March 10th. The Colonial Theater in Laconia, New Hampshire on March 11th. And Flynn Center in Burlington, Vermont on March 12th. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all that info and ticket links. Also, I just want to make sure people know that I've got... The Moon Tower Festival, Paramount Theater, April 22nd, Austin, Texas. Again, WTFpod.com/tour for all of those dates. There's a lot of dates, a lot of different places. Okay? All right. Okay, enough of that. I have to mark and acknowledge and be grateful for the life I'm living in the face of fascism, hatred, environmental disaster, the slow crumbling of the social fabric. I have to take a minute to sort of enjoy my real life. And I'll tell you, you'll hear it eventually, but I, I did another interview with Keith Richards yesterday on Zoom. He's got a reissue of Main Offenders coming up, but we took the opportunity. They were like, do you want to talk to Keith again? I'm like, of course. And I pressed him. I pressed him on where he gets his beanies. So look forward to me having that answer and also to that coming. But it was just a thrill because no matter, I talked to him a long time ago and I just completely lost my mind. And I thought maybe I've got it together, but I don't. Completely lost my mind again. But I got him all excited. It's fun to get him going. And also another hero, Keith Richards, since I was like 14, 15. What am I going to, how am I going to keep my shit together, even if I'm on Zoom? But not unlike Keith Richards, you know, David Letterman was the, you know, that was the bar, man. That was it for talk shows and for being on a talk show. I spent most of my life as a comic wanting to get on Letterman and eventually getting on. And then I eventually had the opportunity to talk to him here at the house, and it was great. But I was on at the Comedy Store the other night in the main room, and it was one of those sets where it was a produced show. It wasn't a regular show. It was a comic produced show. I was filling in for Jeff Ross even. And I don't know. I you know, the audience was okay, but it's always weird with the produced shows because I don't know where they come from. They're not an organic audience. They're all reached through the same avenue, and I don't know. They were fine. They were good, but it was just different. And I was kind of snotty at first. I was kind of like fighting it. But then I ended up pushing through and doing the shit I'm doing right now. I'm doing the shit. I'm doing the stand-up comedy work. I'm doing the real work. I love doing club work. Especially that club. But anyway, so I get off stage. Security guy from the club comes back and he says, David Letterman wants to talk to you. And I'm like, what? David Letterman wants to talk to you. I'm like, what are you talking about? Is he here? Yeah, he's here. And my then I said, wait, what? Am I in trouble? It was half joking, but I'm like, did I do something wrong? Am I in trouble? Why is he doing here? And I went out, and on the back patio, David Letterman was there with a couple of people, and he was just there, and he just wanted to say hi and tell me that he thought that the stuff I was doing right now was important, and somebody's got to be saying it, and nobody's really saying it, and he was happy I was saying it, and then we kind of had a few laughs and chatted a bit. He told me about a little bit about his time there and having a few memories of the place. But this guy was, you know, my hero. So I talked to two heroes of mine in the last week. One surprise, I was surprised. It was a surprise visit. The other one, you know, was planned. I'll tell you what's great. And I had this moment with Eddie Murphy, too, right at the beginning. It's great to make Keith Richards laugh, and it's great to make Letterman laugh. I mean, you know, we are all familiar with Letterman's laugh. Because, you know, I've been listening to it for half my life. But just to be right there with it, see it happening in real time, what a fucking treat. What a fucking treat. What a life I'm living. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right, so Mira Sorvino is in this new star series called Shining Veil. It premieres this Sunday, March 6th. And again, listen to me. This is a content warning that our conversation deals very frankly with sexual harassment, abuse, misogyny, and the general mistreatment of human beings. So I want you to know that ahead of time. This is what we're doing. We also have some nice things. There's nice things. There's fun things. There's some great experiences spoken about, but we're okay. We're people here. This is me talking to Mira Sorvino. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. You know. I watched a bit of the new show, and it's a fun show. It seems like a fun show.
Mm-hmm.
Are you
it's
happy?
Very fun. Yeah, yeah? Shining Vale. Yeah, I love it.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, you have to. I mean, in terms of like my character, you have to stick with it for a few episodes to really meet her because she's sort of haunting the edges in the beginning, and you don't really see her much.
The slow unfolding.
Yeah.
Of the ghost presence who takes over the writing process. Is that how it works?
Kind of, yeah. Not just the writing, but yeah, she kind of takes over.
Yeah. And is it fun working with...
Courtney Cox.
Yes.
It's amazing. She's just a doll and so talented and so humble and fun and beautiful and just the perfect straight man. Like, she's so good at playing reality but making it funny.
Mm.
You know, she doesn't do like a big character or anything. I'm more like, I create like the big weird characters to be funny. She's just funny as the normal person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's what she's been doing forever. She's like,
but that's what makes a person a star. You know,
yeah,
I mean? Like the,
for sure.
Like the old movies, like you wanted to see that person again and again.
Yeah. And Kinnear too, right?
Oh, he's hilarious.
He's a good guy. You know, how long have you lived out here? When did you were in New York, weren't you?
I was in New York full time until 2001. Then I bought my place out here, and then I was bi-coastal until 2014. And then we had to choose a coast because the kids were in school. We have four kids.
Four.
And so once you're really in a school year, like, you can't maintain two properties on two coasts. Like, why? Because you're going to be there for 3 weeks a year? Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And, like, that's crazy. How old's your oldest one?
17.
So the pandemic must have been a nightmare. I mean,
well,
did you get tight? Did you get closer?
Well, we were always close.
Right.
I think it was very hard on them. I mean, but we had each other, you know, some people who had no one during the pandemic, I think, fared far worse.
Right.
I think actually having a big family made it more bearable, even if everybody was getting cabin fever, but yeah.
Really? Didn't no one went totally crazy?
It's a question of degree.
So like when you were growing up, were you around actors all the time?
Actors would be friends with my parents, and you know, my mother was also an actress, and then she gave it up to be a full-time mom, something which I never understood as a kid, but now I understand. If I had the luxury, I could totally see
it. But you never gave it up.
No, well, I never gave it up. No, I couldn't, because economically I couldn't.
Right.
But
God, it must have been a lot.
But you know, there's but we did have a lot of actors that my father worked with that
in
would
New
come
York.
To the house, or you know, opera singers, you know, politicians, and like, you know, there was all kinds of culture coming in and out of our dining room.
Uh-huh.
You know, my parents would throw dinner parties. Like,
oh wow! So
they were very good at entertaining. Like that, I don't have that skill.
No,
I used to when I was like young and single. I used to throw these apartment parties in New York and just fit like 100 people into an 400 square foot, like, walk up, you know, I don't know how, but, I don't know. I think with all the kids and obviously with the past 2 years, there's just been no entertaining, but
of course.
Hopefully we'll open it up again and people will go back to normal to some extent. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I think we can take the masks off as of today inside.
Wow.
So everyone can finally get it.
Yeah. Right. Well, I just had it, so I
did too.
Kind of glad in a way, because you spend 2 years afraid it's going to kill you.
Yeah.
And then you have it. It's not great, but I didn't die, so I'm very happy about that.
It's weird coming on. It doesn't feel like anything else, does it? It like people were saying it's like a cold. It didn't feel like a cold to me.
No, it didn't feel like a cold, no.
Wait, I'm all vaxxed up, but it felt weird. Like, I felt weird. What? How was your symptoms? Bad?
Well, the first, I don't know. The first few days, I had this extreme lower back pain that I thought was my kidneys failing.
Wow.
But it
would there
might
be any
also,
reason for that?
It might also have been because I had just broken my arm.
Mm.
And so I was taking painkillers for my arm because it was like really extreme. And I think it was too much for my body to process. And I think my kidneys were just complaining.
Yeah.
As soon as I stopped taking them, it went away.
Right.
Now, it could have just been a weird early COVID symptom.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. But I had like blood work done, and I had like a scan for kidney stones, and nothing came up.
No,
there was nothing. So,
it was just you don't know.
I don't know.
But that maybe it was COVID. But what were the general symptoms? I just felt kind of congested, tired, tightness in my chest a little.
I had like fever the whole time.
Oh.
But low.
Yeah.
Like never went over 100, but my usual temperature is like 97 point something. So like for me, a 99.8 is a fever.
Right.
Whereas somebody else, they'd be like, oh, you barely have a, you know.
Right,
but,
sure.
But that lasted for like 11 days.
Yeah.
And I felt that kind of, like no one understands in my family when I describe it, but I get these little shocks in my joints, like a little. Like these little electrical.
Huh.
Like jolts when I'm sick, and that was happening a lot, and I was sort of sweating, and I had the a cough
that never
went into anything like, you know, pneumonia or anything, but I still have this residual cough that, you know, it's like
you do. Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's I mean I'm COVID free. I've been tested several times.
I know. It took me like 12 days. It was like 12 days, and it was driving me nuts.
Yeah,
because you start comparing yourself to other people.
Yeah,
like how come that person only had 3 days?
Yeah.
We're going, and just like you start to feel even like there was that weird feeling of like I failed, I lost, I was winning for 2 years.
Right. And, I started to think that I was naturally immune. Like I was like everyone around
getting
has had
cocky,
it. I'm not
right?
getting it. Like I was on sets where like 8 out of 10 of us would get it. I wouldn't get it. Like it's just like how do I not have it?
Well, I must be amazing. So all right. So you grow up in this like salon of talent. And excitement. How many kids in your family?
I was the oldest of three. I have a brother and a sister, Michael Sorvino and Amanda Sorvino.
He's an actor too?
Michael's an actor, yeah.
And now, like, were you inspired to be in show business?
Yes. I mean, although I came to it through doing, like, my own plays in school. Like, that's how I fell in love with it.
By writing plays?
No. Well, I actually wrote plays when I was really little, actually. When I was, like, six, I did a play actually with the actress Hope Davis, who lived across the street from
Hope Davis. Are you guys still friends?
We haven't seen each other in a long time. I mean, we're friendly when we see each other. But, I mean, we moved away from that street when I was, like, 10. So.
Where was that? In New York?
In Tenafly, New Jersey.
I like New Jersey.
It's beautiful. You appreciate it once you've left it.
Yeah.
At the time, I was like, oh, I can't wait to move to the city. Or, you know, I can't imagine living here as an adult. And now I'm like, oh, it was so nice and it would be wonderful for the kids.
Right now. Yeah, like, everything changes.
Yeah.
So what was the amazing play that you starring you and Hope Davis at
age 6?
It was
called The Dutch Doll.
Oh, The Dutch Doll.
I was a girl and I had a doll. She was the doll.
Yeah.
And the doll was sick and it had to go to the doll doctor.
Oh,
and I was
exciting.
Very worried about it. Yes. And we performed it for the whole neighborhood in our backyard.
Did the doll live?
The doll lived, yes.
Oh, happy ending.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
So, but were you doing a lot of acting in high school and stuff?
Yeah, I was. I mean, not professionally. I just acted in all the plays at school. And then at 16 and a half, a talent scout came to my high school looking for girls who could horseback ride and act.
Hmm.
And I happened to have a horse and compete in like hunter jumper shows.
Oh, you did?
And I was in all the plays. And so my school recommended me and like 6 other girls. Apparently there were a lot of us. And it was basically like a reboot of National Velvet called Sylvester.
Mm.
And they were doing this nationwide like search. Ultimately, I had like 3 callbacks and a screen test, but then they gave it to Melissa Gilbert. But that started my career because we had a friend of the family who was a child manager.
Mm.
And she heard about me because of having clients, I guess, in the mix. And she said, you know, it's really encouraging that Mira got that far. If you want, I could represent her.
Yeah.
And so she ended up being my manager for like a decade.
Really?
Yeah.
It's so weird with acting because, like, you know, it's you get into it by being rejected.
Yeah.
It's the fucking worst. I mean, I can't, like, I could, like, I've always done comedy and I've acted now a bit, but just what actors go through, to the rejection is insane.
Yeah, you get well, it's sort of like baseball, though. It's sort of like, you know, how your batting average, even if you're an amazing hitter, you're going to strike out like 70% of the time, you know?
Yeah.
So
you were able to contextualize that, like to compartmentalize that much just as a young person, like that, like it's not really on you, that they don't want you?
I think, well, my father used to say he did not want us to be actors because it was so personal and because compared to another job where when they reject you, it's like your resume isn't strong enough or they want somebody with a skill of that or whatever.
Sure.
But when you're an actor, they're rejecting you. They don't want you.
Right.
And so he just really wanted us to become anything but actors. But then when I was 23 and I was out of college and I was taking this course at the International Center for Photography in New York and we had to do like... We had to shoot a roll of film every day and write in a journal and try and like sort of keep our creative muse awakened. And as I would journal, I realized oh, my art form right now to say whatever it is I have inside me is acting. Uh-huh. Like, I really need to be an actor.
You just felt that?
Yeah. It was this calling that came to me while I was in this. I mean, I had always been acting. I never stopped. But I was doing a lot of other things, too. I was interning at Tribeca Productions, and then I got hired by them as a reader, and I thought maybe I wanted to be a director, and I thought maybe I wanted to be a photographer.
And what did you study in school, though?
East Asian Languages and Civilizations.
But, what was that about?
It was Chinese studies, basically. But Tiananmen Square happened during my senior year. Were you there? No. I had just come back from China after having lived there for 8 months.
Well, and what was the compulsion, though? Like, you know, what made you study that? What was the fascination originally?
I think freshman year I took this incredible course by K.C. Jong, this famous archaeologist on politics, art, and mythology in Bronze Age China. And I loved it so much.
Wow.
And they were like, you know, there's this concentration. You can study anything you want as long as it pertains to East Asia. Like, you could study the politics of the Vietnam War, Japanese, like, Shinto architecture,
right.
You know, Tang poetry, anything you wanted, as long as it pertained to East Asia. And so I ended up writing my thesis about racial conflict, but in a Chinese context. And it was basically like a sociology, anthro kind of thesis, even though I'd been like humanities, like literature, history the whole time.
Harvard?
Harvard, yeah. So it was like this multidisciplinary concentration at a time that there weren't many other concentrations where you could study more than one or two things. Like, you could do history and lit, which would allow you to do history and lit of your countries that you spoke the language of.
Yeah.
But you couldn't take like art from the same period and have it count, whereas anything went under this EALC canopy.
Right.
And I kind of felt like I'd been Chinese in another life. Like, I was very good friends and still am with a woman named Angela Wong, who's now a doctor, and we're still really close.
Yeah.
And she used to take me with her family to Chinatown when I was a kid and Peking opera and playing mahjong with her grandma. And for some reason, I really connected with the traditional culture.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I went to China and was living there and studying there. I was like, where's the traditional culture? Like, communism had kind of changed it so much.
Right.
But then, like, when you really got into people's homes, that same element was still there. And they were actually very much like Italians. It was kind of funny, but like, Chinese people are super warm and family oriented and touchy feely. And food is love and, you know, great boisterous belly laughs. And I felt very, very much at home once I became close friends with Chinese people over there.
I think it's a language barrier that makes us unaware of their emotional nature. You know what I mean? I think that for a lot of regular white people, that there's like, it's just this, it's hard for some reason for us to understand.
Well, I think also there might be a conflation between like Japanese culture and Chinese culture because the Japanese have much more ceremony and like hierarchy in their you know, language even.
Yeah.
You know, there's grammar of like, you're inferior, you're superior, this and that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Whereas Chinese is, I mean, there's definitely, you know, saving face and being polite and everything, but there's a ton of warmth in it. It's very warm, very, very warm people.
And you spoke it?
Yeah, yeah. By the time I left there, I was pretty fluent. I was like dreaming in it, and I had rented a room from a Chinese woman for my second half of the time I stayed there. And I wrote, like, I edited Chinese language magazines, and I sang jazz with Chinese European bands. I had like fake books, so everybody wanted to be like, have me in their band so they could get my music.
Wow.
My dad would send me like fake books of all like the jazz standards, and then I was singing like Satin Doll and One for My Baby and One for the Road.
In Chinese?
I sang like Autumn Leaves in French, and the rest of it I sang in English. But the funny thing is, actually in Shining Veil, they let me sing One for My Baby and One for the Road in the show. And that was like my big hit song in China. So.
In French, down the show?
Yeah, not in French. No, no. Oh. Autumn Leaves was in French, but One for My Baby, One for the Road, like the Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald kind of stuff.
Do you love to sing?
I do. I do. I mean, I don't have a big voice,
but
I do love to sing. And
do you ever think of doing like a cabaret act?
I was in a show at Don't Tell Mamas when I was in New York, and I always plan to like do singer-songwriter stuff, and I've written a couple of songs, and then just life gets in the way and I don't do it. And like, you know, like I have a guitar and then the guitar cracked, or then I broke my arm, or, you know, like, but I always have these ideas.
Yeah.
And it's something that when I have a little bit more time, but in the context of this, you know, I happened to tell Jeff Astroff, you know, I sing a little and, you know, there's this song, and he was like, okay, well, why don't you record it?
Yeah.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
So then I got to record it, and then then I told him that I danced. And then he created this incredible opening for, I think it's episode 8 or 9.
In Shining Vale.
In Shining Vale, yeah. Where I get to do an homage to, like, it's short, but to, yeah. like, you know, Fred Astaire dancing with the coat rack or yeah. Gene Kelly with the mop. Like, I do this whole sort of little 50s-style balletic dance around the house with various household implements, like a mop and uh-huh. a feather duster. And it was the time of my life. Like, I was so happy. I can't even tell you how happy I was. It was like I had stepped into an old movie. Like, I was so happy.
Really? Did yeah. they bring a choreographer in?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah.
exciting.
Right? Yeah, and I had taken like 8 years of ballet as a kid, you know, so I had some
it's still
technique.
In there?
Yeah, yeah, it's still in there.
Doesn't go away.
No, no, especially, and I, as an adult, like, sometimes I study with Romy Rappaport, who's just an amazing teacher. She used to be part of the New York City Ballet.
Uh-huh.
And her sister Zipporah also sometimes used to teach me. So I kept up the ballet a little bit as an adult.
But oh, really?
So much fun. Yeah.
That's nice to have that. And you play guitar too?
Yeah, but not well.
Like, I play. It's like it's a hobby, you know? It's a great thing to have one of those.
Yeah.
Like an outlet.
Yes.
That you're happy about. So how about the Mandarin? Did that stick?
You know, if you drop me in the middle of China within a week, I'd probably be speaking. I'd probably be speaking fluently again. But right yeah. now, like, I'll be speaking a sentence, and then in the middle, I'll forget how to say like magazine, or I'll
right,
forget
right.
you know how to like
sure.
like. But I can kind of BS my way along for a little while. But like, my reading and writing has gone to absolute hell. Like, I, you know, because it's all memorization.
Yeah.
And it requires maintenance. You know, so the characters I've really lost.
Oh,
but it was well, it was a while ago. I mean, like, I graduated in, you know, 89, 90. Like,
sure.
I was class of 89, but I took a semester off to stay in China longer. So,
how long were you there total?
8 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was an amazing experience.
What were you saying about Tiananmen?
So that happened right after I left. And
yeah.
once that happened, it really changed everything for those of us who had been working in the China field, because we couldn't really go back.
Oh,
because
I see.
We would endanger our Chinese friends by associating with them once
really?
That happened. Yeah. And therefore, we'd just be going over and being like expats together with expats in China. Like, why? Why?
Yeah.
Like, the whole point, if you're going to be in China, is to be with Chinese people and live the, you know, within the culture.
Yeah.
And that became very dangerous for Chinese people to have foreign friends at that point. So it was like, well, also, I think all of us wanted to kind of just show our disapproval of what had happened and not be like, oh, it's business as usual. So if that hadn't happened, I might not be an actor today. I mean, maybe I would, but it like pointed me back into the world of like entertainment and going back to New York and
creativity in that way.
Yeah. Whereas I was kind of more on this academic track, and I was maybe going to go teach English again in China when I graduated, maybe in a different province and learn uh-huh. a different dialect. And although while I was in China, I did sing, and then I became friends with one of Bertolucci's like assistant directors on The Last Emperor. And then she had like a Chinese reverse Beatles story where...
Was that shooting there when you were there? Wasn't shooting there when you were there, was it?
I think it had just
yeah.
shot there.
Okay.
I think. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so she wanted me to play a sort of American, like, adjunct, like a sort of parallel to like Yoko Ono, even though Yoko Ono is Japanese, with the Chinese Beatles.
Yeah.
Like, and I'd be the American girlfriend. So strangely, like, acting was still kind of finding me, but yeah. I wasn't looking for it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But if I had, you know, because my parents got divorced while I was in China, and that's one of the reasons I stayed an extra semester, because I wasn't ready to go back to school, because it was too hard for me to be in classes with, like, I was very depressed.
Yeah.
So I just took time off and lived and worked in China for that second semester.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, I kind of righted myself on the other side of the world. Like, I made myself functional and happy again.
You processed the...
Yeah, the grief and
Without having to deal with the drama, I guess, huh?
Well,
I mean, you weren't in it.
Right. I wasn't in it.
That's
sure.
good.
Yeah. But, you know, it had its costs. Like, they sold the house and packed up my room without
oh.
me ever seeing it again. You know what I mean? Like, just everything was gone.
The whole, your whole life room?
Yeah. Well, no, from when we moved from the place where we lived near Hope
yeah.
Davis to, like, because I think we moved when I was 8, actually.
Oh,
yeah. So 8 to 17
oh,
was in that
man.
House. And then.
No, that's
but,
terrible.
You know, this is divorce, you know.
Did you get the boxes? Did you get the stuff?
Some of them never. No.
Oh, so there was loss.
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh. Someone decided it was garbage.
Right. Like, you know, like scrapbooks or
yeah.
you know, things like that. Just
I'm
not
sorry.
There. It's okay. It's
yeah.
just, you know.
Life.
yeah. Everybody has one. So.
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, it's not easy.
Life is not easy. It's much harder than I thought, actually.
It is, right?
Yeah.
It's such a, like, you know, as you get older, too, like, I'm 58, it's just sort of like, is this the big payoff? I mean, what, because, like, when you finally get a handle on shit, it's, you're almost done, it seems, right?
Maybe that's the point, you know, it's a lesson that it takes this long time to learn.
And then it's sort of like, nothing you can do about it, enjoy your wisdom.
Yeah.
So when you have the epiphany at the photography school and the program.
So then I went to my dad and was like, Dad, I know I need to be an actress. Like, it's very clear to me. It's the only thing I want to do. And then he said, well, then I give you my blessing.
Aw.
And that's when I started. And then I kind of turned around from.
So he always talks like the mob boss in Goodfellas?
Like a more cultured version.
Okay.
Like a more Shakespearean version.
Okay.
There's nothing about him that's thuggish, but he is imposing.
What was that movie that he did when he played the heroin-addicted lounge singer?
Oh, that was good. The Cooler.
Right? Yeah, The Cooler.
With Alec Baldwin.
It was amazing.
Yeah. It was rough. That's a sad. It's hard to watch.
Sad.
Yeah, seeing him like a child, like banging the table, needing his fix. Like,
yeah.
You know, my dad, wow.
Yeah, had you never seen him like that?
No.
But he got there, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he can do anything.
Yeah. So what, so you tell him, gives you the blessing.
And then I just started really focusing because I'd been in acting class and I'd been auditioning for things, but I was also doing a little modeling, a little waitressing, you know, like all kinds of stuff. And as soon as I was like, no. This is the only thing I want to do. Mm. And I kind of took this chance and dropped everything else and just started really focusing on my classes and my auditions. I started booking things within like a month.
What classes?
Wynn Handman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was my teacher. I went to Bill Esper during the summer while I was in college. But his is a 2-year course. And honestly, my dad had already taught me most of what he was going to teach me because my dad was a graduate of Bill and Meisner. So
the original Meisner
bunch.
Yeah,
Sandy Meisner. Yeah. He was. Oh, he got so a scholarship to that school.
So
that
your
they
dad would actually like lay stuff on you, like, you know, like this is the deal.
Oh, he would teach me like anytime I had a role to prepare for in high school, he would work with me for hours.
Really?
And then he would come to me after a performance and give me like 2 hours of notes. And yes, would I have appreciated to be like the other parents would be like, honey, that was wonderful. He would say, honey, that was terrific. I just have 2 notes. And they'd sit you down and then you'd get a 2-hour lecture about what you hadn't done right. Mm. But it was from those sessions that I learned. You know, he would be like, every time you go like, and then say your line, you're letting out your first instinct. Mm. You're falsifying whatever you're going to do.
Oh,
you're killing
God.
Your first instinct. Wow. Never exhale before speaking. Just speak the line. Just let it come out.
Wow.
Stick with the other fellow. You'll never be wrong. You might be boring, but you'll never be untruthful. You know, like everything, you know, there was always these notes that would really were the fundamentals of acting. But when I was 8, he taught me how to emotionally prepare because I had to cry. And he had me sit in the middle of the stairway and think of something very sad until there was tears streaming down my face and then come down and play the scene.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So I had this, I don't know that I could teach my kids the same way he did because I don't know if I'd have the emotional fortitude to let them upset themselves at that young of an age because for him, it's the art form and it is the art form. But I think it changed me. I think it made me burn these neural pathways to sadness that I would not have had I not been an actress. Like, I am such a sad person sometimes, and it's because I need to access it all the time for my work. Like, all of my characters cry for some reason. Whatever I get cast in, they always cry, even if it's a big, fat comedy like Romy and Michelle. She cries like 4 or 5 times in the show. And
maybe they know you're good at it.
I don't know. But it's sort of, I don't know. I think I have this weird sweet spot between like zany and vulnerable for the comedy stuff and the vulnerable side, there's always a crying scene. And so I had to get to the point, and my father also always used to say, the day I use the tears is the day I walk out of the business. And so it was anathema, the idea that I would ever use glycerin tears or camphor to make yourself tear up, because a lot of actors do that.
Sure.
You know, they'll, like, well, right before they go on, they'll blow it in their eyes. Their eyes will kind of glass up, and then right in the middle of the scene, the tear will roll down perfectly down their straight. I cannot do that. I'll have to kill myself.
That's right. Yeah. So, it's been planted in you.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I just have to sit there and destroy myself emotionally and bring myself to the worst day of my life. And then I'm sobbing and I have to do it for hours and hours and take after take. And that's the legacy of Paul Sorvino's 8-year-old daughter learning to cry in the middle of the stairs.
But that's interesting, though, that you think that you actually carved some sad paths.
Oh, absolutely.
Because of your ability to access it. And then when you're not accessing it, you still got the thing.
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, I think I already am sort of like an empath or like somebody who feels things a little deeper than your average Joe. But it definitely made those sensitivities heightened.
It's like I have some of those tendencies where, you know, people can just... I'm projecting now, but like the empath thing or the sensitivity, it's hard to maintain boundaries. And people are, you know, they definitely see you as an emotional mark sometimes, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I think that sometimes I would hide it.
Yeah.
But what, I would always feel it. I don't know.
Can we hide it? I don't know. Because I'm doing stand-up up there lately with the world the way it is. And like, I'll stop in the middle of my act and go like, these jokes are starting to make me cry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because things get heavy, you know?
Yeah. Things are heavy now. And it's funny because, you know, I've been watching all the Academy films because, you know, I have to vote. And
good for you for being
so
diligent.
Well, it was great that I had that to do during COVID.
Yeah.
Because I basically couldn't get out of my bed. So I was just like, all right, I'm going to watch some documentaries now.
Do it all.
Yeah, do it all. Watch the foreign films, everything. But I was really struck by how negative most of the films were. I was so surprised about the tone, the darkness of so much of the most fetid stuff out there. But I think it's appropriate for what we've been living through.
Sure.
You know, it's just the mindset.
What struck you, though? Like, what do you mean?
Well, I was like, wow, these films are so negative without a spot of
negative
light.
Negative or dark?
Negative and dark.
Hmm. Like, did you watch Drive My Car?
Yes. And I actually really like Drive My Car.
Right?
It took some getting into because the pace is slow.
But that's like dark, but it's like it's
No,
it's
but
human.
That's not as dark. Yeah, that's not what I mean. That one's not negative. That
it's
one
grief.
Has a life-affirmingness at the end or a sort of this is what life is and we have to make peace with it.
Right.
And like doing the Chekhov, you know, and with the sign language and then we will rest, then we will look back on how we suffered that's like our fate. Like we all want what we can't have. We want to change the reality and we can't.
Yeah.
Like we just can't undo what is real.
Yes.
And it's so heartbreaking though. Like life, that's why life is so hard because, you know, I think we're spoon-fed with these happy ending. You know, if there's a will, there's a way. You dream it, you can do it. And then certain things cannot change no matter what. And certain things befall you, which are out of the sky, that are so hard that you never could have imagined them in a million years. And there's nothing you can do about them. You are disempowered. You don't have agency sometimes. And that goes against our culture, which always tells us that we can do something about everything. But there's not always something you can do about loss, death, you know, betrayal, like the change. You can't.
Yeah. Power structures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the world turning on its head and people going crazy and becoming racist again. Or maybe they always were. We just didn't know it.
But, yeah. There's like something happened on stage last night where I just like because I was like, I just said, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, it's just like, it's okay, folks. Cry.
There's so right.
And then we can cry.
Yeah, I guess so. Cry or
cry or hug or something.
Yeah.
But yeah. Just, yeah. So this has been like a weird life lesson past few years. And I'm wow, I just didn't see it coming.
I feel like we're about to drift into sadness, you and I.
All right. Yeah. We're egging each other on.
I know. We're just waiting for each other to cry. But you can do it on purpose, apparently. Mine, I can't control that well. So it looked like when I was looking at some of the movies that you did early on, you were part of that like New York crew of actors and stuff and people in that time.
I was definitely in New York and making
Imperioli
all the movies there.
And those guys. And what's that guy, Winnick? Is that guy's
Gary
name?
Gary Winnick. He directed Sweet Nothing.
Yeah.
He's dead.
I know.
Brain cancer.
But he had a little, wasn't there a casting operation running out of his office as well? I mean, I remember being at his office for some reason. Maybe
Gary,
I'm thinking of somewhere
else. He may
else.
Have. I mean, I think he was the son of somebody who had a lot of money.
Oh, okay.
And there may have been a family element to that.
When you started working there, it seemed like a pretty vital, like your generation anyways, I'm putting you in that. Did you feel that?
Oh, yeah. No, and I was working over at Tribeca Productions with Jane Rosenthal and De Niro, like reading scripts and... You know,
so you saw Robert around a lot?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And my dad obviously was friends with him. You know,
He's a good guy, right?
Yeah. And he gave me one of my first jobs in the business.
Oh, yeah?
As a reader.
Like, right.
At first I interned and then I got hired. So that was awesome. Very hard job to read scripts. You have to...
And make notes.
Read them. And then you've got to boil down their plot to like 3/4 of a page.
Yeah.
And then you have to have a paragraph of like suggest... Yeah. Consider or decline. And me being a non-decisive person who doesn't like to destroy people's futures, I was always like, well, it's like a B-plus script that could be an A-minus if they just did this and that, and if they just developed this, or the characters' voices were a little different. And they were like, Mira.
Yeah.
You know, one day, because I had suggested one script and said consider on two others out of like a whole season of scripts that I was reading.
Yeah.
And Jane Rosenthal called me into her office and she was like, Mira, in order for you to say consider, this script needs to be worth millions of dollars and 2 years of my time.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. Got it. Did not. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because I always felt bad for the writers. Like, I just wanted to give them their shot.
Was not the job for you.
No. Anything where I have to choose anything is not my job. Like, I can't choose between anything. My kids are always trying to make me choose my favorite of something, and I can never choose. Even my daughter, when she sends me pictures to post on her Instagram, choose your favorites. I don't know. They're all cute, Matea. Mom!
Yeah.
I just can't.
Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. I experienced some of that, too. It's frustrating.
Yeah. I wish I were more decisive.
I mean,
must be so nice to be decisive.
I find that in a pinch, like if I'm up against the wall, I can make a pretty confident decision. If there's a panic, I can do it. So what I try to do is get myself into as much panic as possible.
Just live on the edge all the time.
Exactly. Because then everything feels urgent enough to decide immediately. So when, like, as it evolves, though, well, obviously the big break is the Woody Allen movie, right?
Yes, although the first big break was, I mean, maybe Whit Stillman's Barcelona.
Oh, that's a great movie. That guy's an interesting guy.
He is, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what happened to him.
He's still working. He just takes long periods of time between projects. Yeah.
Because there was a couple of those movies that he did.
Metropolitan, Las Vegas Disco.
But yeah, there was a tone to those movies that were very specific.
It was a Whit Stillman movie.
Yes, Whit Stillman, yeah.
And so I got cast in that, and then I got cast by Robert Redford in Quiz Show, and that was a huge deal for me as a young actor.
So how was it working with those directors? I mean, like, you did those... Like, amongst friends, okay, so that was an indie movie. But then you're in the big time. So, like, working with Stillman, like, what? Because he's, like, a real tonal guy. How'd that work?
Well, I'm a lot freer than he is.
Yeah.
And so I think we, at the time, perhaps, like, butted heads a little bit about my more slightly improvisational style and his saying, you missed a comma.
Right.
But ultimately, I think he was very happy with what I did.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of mutual respect and fondness for each other, so I would work with him again. I think it would be very interesting
to do it now?
His world now. Yeah.
Is he still, like, the guy I was thinking of is Christopher, how do you say his last
Chris
name?
Chris Eigenman.
Eigenman, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah.
He's
an
intense guy.
He is, and with that biting humor.
Yeah.
Very biting.
Here.
And then there's Taylor Nichols,
Yeah.
But that was a super experience getting to live in Barcelona and play a Catalan girl, and it was super fascinating. So, and it went from that, and then I got the Woody Allen movie.
But the Quiz Show, how was working with Redford?
Oh, amazing, but terrifying, because like he used to do like 20 takes per angle. And I was coming from indie world where we were working with short ends in like the last bits of cans of film while we were still using film.
Right.
And you never had time for more than 5 takes ever. And so when we were getting up on take 18, 19, 20, I was like, oh, I'm screwing up. Oh, they're going to recast. I can see the casting director over there. They're looking at me. They're going to call the other girl and say, we made a mistake. Can you be here tomorrow? Like, that's how I felt.
Yeah.
And then I came home from work and I was so despondent. And my dad's
after
like, what's wrong? Well, like after the first day.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, Dad, I think they're going to fire me. Like, they did so many takes and I felt like he was not getting what he wanted. And I just felt like, and he said, well, look, You go in there and you take your best swing at it and just say blanket.
Yeah.
Just say the F word.
Yeah.
You know, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
You could get fired.
Yeah.
Everybody gets fired at some point in their career. But if you don't take a big artistic leap,
yeah,
like you take a chance on something you feel really strong about, you'll never do something interesting. You'll never fly. You might fall on your face, but you'll never fly if you don't take that big leap of courage.
Sure.
And that was like the best advice ever. And like just to have the courage of your convictions and really go for it.
Yeah.
And what's the worst that could happen? So, and I didn't get fired, and it all worked out fine. I mean, he did tell me that I had to stop like using my hand so much because she was Jewish, not Italian. And you know, so he said, try and catch your hand, because I would be talking like this, and he said, catch your fingers, catch them, catch it.
Well, you were Totoro's wife?
Yes. And he's like, catch your fingers.
Yeah.
So I did. Like, you'll see. I'm going like,
you're catching your fingers.
Instead of like.
Yeah. All right. So then Woody casts you. Did you have to audition for that?
Mm-hmm.
You did.
And the first audition, I was told that it was good, but I was too far away from the character.
Uh-huh.
And my agents were like, but wait, you know, because like they only handed us the sides like 2 minutes before the audition. We knew nothing about the character except that she was unfettered and had no idea. I had to ask in the room if she was like a call girl. I did not even know.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
So I hadn't come in with that as the character, you know. I played it for real, but then my agents were like, wait, no, you don't understand, she's a real chameleon, you got to see her as this Catalan girl in the Whit Stillman movie. And then I guess Woody requested to screen a print of Barcelona.
Oh, really?
And then he said, wait a second, this girl has nothing to do with the girl I met last year for Don't Drink the Water. This is like not the same person.
Don't Drink the Water?
Yeah.
You auditioned for that?
Yeah.
They did a revival of Don't Drink the Water?
Uh-huh.
I did that in college. I played the old man.
Yeah. And so he's like, have her come in again. So I went in England while I was working on The Buccaneers, which was an Edith Wharton miniseries for the BBC, where I was playing another like half Brazilian heiress. You know, I only used to get characters with like vowels at the end of their name. At the beginning of my career, I could only play ethnic people. I could never play just nondescript, non-specifically ethnic people.
Why is that? You don't look particular.
It's because I dyed my hair blonde that I don't look it. Like,
oh, really?
It's one of the reasons I stay blonde. It's weird, but like I was not castable. Like people would say weird things like, she's too urban.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, urban? I grew up in like suburban New Jersey. I went to Harvard. Yeah. Like, what? I'm not urban. I'm just Italian.
Yeah.
Half Italian. My mother's English, Scottish, Welsh, you know, German.
Right.
Like, I'm not. But because of my exotic name, Mira Sorvino.
Okay.
Because I didn't change it. I
always looking to box people in, too.
Yeah, at that point, especially.
Yeah.
Now I can't play half the roles that I played then because they would be seen as taking them away from somebody who was Latina.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't have been able to play at least 3 or 4 of the roles that I played early on because I was, you know, ethnically not authentic.
Although maybe
I still could have played Catalan because she's European, you know, Spanish and Italian. I mean, you saw the big deal about Javier Bardem even.
It's a little tricky and specific now.
There was a whole controversy that he's Spanish and is playing Cuban.
Yeah.
Like, but I mean, I don't know
where. Oh, that's right, for the Ricardos.
Know.
Right,
So,
okay.
But that was the kind of thing that early in my career, I couldn't play a girl who wasn't either Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, Puerto Rican. Like, I couldn't play Joe Schmo girl from middle of America.
Right.
All that changed when I colored my hair blonde, and then I could play anything.
And I
did it for Mighty Aphrodite because the character should be blonde because she was this sort of, you know, ditzy character, but like a bad blonde, like not even a well done dye job.
That was a great performance. Did you feel good about the performance?
I did. I was very nervous about it the whole time because that was one of those ones where I made that huge leap of faith in terms of a big, weird artistic choice with that voice. Like, it was a very strange choice, you know? And I was even questioned on it like several weeks in. Like 5 weeks in, I think.
By who? Woody.
He was like, did you ever think about doing a different voice? And I said, what? And he said, well, you know, like Diane Wiest, she played around with a few different voices on Bullets. And, you know, after doing one for a while, we switched to another one. That was the one we ended up doing. And then we, you know, reshot everything. And I was like, but we've already shot for like 5 weeks. And he said, oh, I've got it built into my budget that I can do the entire movie over. I can reshoot the entire movie. I have that in my budget. I was like, oh, okay. And then, and people had been
fired.
And
it's fired. On you, the non-decider.
People had been fired already several
from that
times.
Movie?
Yes. The one character had been recast like three times, and
wow.
One of them was played by somebody I really respected, and she got fired. But then, like, so I said, so do you want me to change it? Because I will. I just want you to know that if I change the voice, she'll be a different character, but I can do that, whatever you want me to do. And he was like, huh, I thought it was more like a put-on thing, like Rich Little, like, you know, impressions. And I was like, oh, no, I stand by that this person talks this way. If I do a different voice, she'll be a different person, but I'm happy to do that. Do you want me to do it? And he said, no, I was just thinking out loud. And I was like, okay,
wow.
Maybe don't tell me next time because you just put the fear of God into me.
Keep it in your head next time.
Yeah. You know, and it's so hard to talk about it now because, like, I now have a very different opinion of Woody than I did then. And I blame myself for not investigating further into what happened with Dylan.
Sure.
And
was that information out there then?
There was the whole custody battle, and there it was in the press. Mm. It was pre Mighty Aphrodite. But everyone, you know, the way that the press had kind of skewed it was that this was
vindictive,
possibly drummed up as a reason to punish him for leaving her for Sun Yi.
Right.
And I mean, look, just the fact that he was with Sun Yi should have been enough.
Yeah.
It should have been enough for everybody to be like, daughter, what? You know?
Yeah.
But I have become since friends with Dylan, and she's an amazing person, and I have no doubt in my mind that she's telling the truth. So it really kind of in a certain way ruins
sure.
Mighty Aphrodite for me, ruins my Oscar performance, ruins that like start of my career because I treasured it for years. And then it's like, I should have denounced him and I should have known it then. I didn't know it then, but I didn't look deep enough to actually educate myself to really make a real educated opinion at the time. It's not an excuse. I should have.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a public apology letter to Dylan Farrow denouncing Woody and saying, you know, if we have to kill all the old gods, so be it. You know, mm-hmm. like just because he was as brilliant as he was, just because I grew up reading his books and performing his plays in my high school and just idolizing him, doesn't mean he's not a terrible person who hurt his daughter, who hurt a child. And there is no forgiveness for that.
Right.
So, but it really taints it.
Sure, of course.
It's so crazy that so much of my early career is tainted by that man and by Harvey Weinstein. Like just really... It's sort of breathtaking.
Those two, it's the same movie, right?
Well, but I did four movies with Harvey. But yes, but that was the movie on which Harvey started paying attention to me and making predatory moves on me.
Yeah.
It was during the press for Mighty Aphrodite. I'd already made two other movies with him.
But nothing.
Nothing, no. But he didn't really take notice of me on the others.
Which movies?
Beautiful Girls and...
Oh, yeah. It's a big cast.
Smoke.
He probably had other focuses.
Or Blue in the Face. Blue in the Face. And then later I did Mimic with his brother, which is a whole other story.
But you worked with Del Toro.
Right,
that must have been good.
Yeah, that was amazing. But they fired Guillermo in the middle of it, and I got him rehired.
Like, really?
Yes, because they hadn't consulted with me and my agents and my lawyers. And
who the hell else was going to direct that movie?
Ole Bornedal from Within, like a Swedish producer who was on it, was going to take over, which is actually against the Directors Guild rules.
Okay.
So... like, I asked Guillermo, do you want to keep doing this? And he said, yes. And I said, okay, well, then we're going to fight it. So my lawyers and my agents came in and they were like, look, you didn't follow the contract. You were supposed to give Mira a list of 12 other directors, give her 24 hours to like go over the list if you were going to agree, you know, do it. And then Harvey said to Guillermo, come down and recut the assembled cut.
Yeah.
We'll give you 11 hours. So he came and, you know, because an editor had been putting it together and they weren't happy with what they were getting. And he was over budget or over time or whatever. He went, flew to New York, recut it. And Harvey said to Bob, this is fantastic. I don't know what your problem is. He's back on. So Guillermo has told me that if I had not done that, he would not have a career.
Oh, wow.
Like, because being fired from your first big movie is a huge thing. That was his first big movie. So.
Oh, that's good.
But
but then you got your career screwed up.
Yes, but my career was screwed up because Harvey wanted to sleep with me and I wouldn't. And so, you know, that's.
But it's like, it's so terrible because, you know, you can see where, you know, after the Oscar, you did, you know, a few big movies. And they were good. And, you know, you didn't lose any money or anything. And everyone, you were doing your job and it was great. And then all of a sudden, just boom.
Just dropped off the face
exile.
Of the earth. Dropped off the face of the earth, yes. Couldn't, did not work in a studio movie for 20 years. 20 years from 30 to 50. And that's really, or 32 to 52, I don't know.
But initially, you didn't know you were being exiled or blackballed.
Mm-hmm. No, it just was bad luck or just not going my way. Just each time, oh, I came down to the last few, but no, they want to go a different way, or they don't think
that's what they told you.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I would go up for a bunch of things. I'd audition for a bunch of things all the time.
And it's also weird, you know, not weird, but terrible. But like outside of, you know, finding out, which you eventually did.
Yes, way later.
But even like let's say that you know the excuse was she's difficult. That was the code, right?
Mm-hmm, that was the code, yeah. Of course, though, I had made three movies with him and was never difficult, you see.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I rejected him sexually, all of a sudden I was difficult.
Yeah.
You know, so, right? No one said I was difficult. Woody didn't say I was difficult. Spike Lee didn't say I was difficult. But all of a sudden, he told the Lord of the Rings people that I was difficult. They were going to cast me.
Was he producing that?
He was initially, and then they moved on to New Line, but the well had already been poisoned and Peter Jackson was like, oh, Harvey said she's difficult, so I'm not going to cast her, even though he had moved over to a different, and he wrote me a huge apology letter after it came out, the whole Me Too stuff. Peter Jackson and his wife wrote me this gigantic, beautiful apology letter about how they had been all set to cast me and they did not do their due diligence and they realized that the only source they had this information from was Harvey. And they are profoundly sorry and that they should have cast me and that they would do whatever they could to help me if I needed it.
It's so fucking sad.
It was. And then the next day, Terry Zwigoff called me and made the same call about Bad Santa, said that like he was considering casting me and then they would hang up on him when he brought up my name. And like those are just two that have admitted it. But that bad reputation thing, like it's so pervasive, you know, like.
Yeah, because it's a relatively small business.
Right. And if, you know, if Harvey's out there telling everybody, don't work with Mira Sorvino, she's really difficult. I went on to a blacklist. There was a blacklist that I was on for years and years and years and years in the studio system.
And
all I could do was indies. I did indies and I did television. And I wasn't willing, you know, and that could be seen as my fault, but I wasn't willing to leave my children for like a full-time network, you know, procedural that would make me away from them all the time when they were really little.
Yeah.
So I could have had more success on TV than I did had I been willing to take those jobs that would have meant me completely sacrificing my motherhood, but I would have made a lot of money.
But it's like a double whammy. You were getting, you know, slandered and maligned and put on a blacklist. And also, you know, even if you were difficult, that doesn't stop people from giving men parts.
Right. But I wasn't difficult.
No, I know. But then on top of that, you had a family, which is another weird strike against women in this business.
Right. Well, I also lost several parts over the years from being pregnant. As soon as they found out you were pregnant, they took the offer away. Because they just, oh, well, it just doesn't work for us. You know, romantically, the characters have to be sexual and you'll be like 8 months at that point and that's just not going to work. Or, you know, but like it's a thing where you can't tell people that you're pregnant before you get the job.
Yeah.
Because they're not supposed to be able to fire you after the fact. But if they know beforehand, they just will find a reason not to hire you because insurance-wise, it's hard for them to.
Right.
But, you know, as actors, obviously, it's a visual medium. So if
you get
the second half of the pregnancy, I've made several projects pregnant. It was in the first trimester.
Right.
It's fine. Look, I'm not here to complain. You know, as we've said, life is hard. I just didn't know this. In a certain way, not knowing it was happening is better. Like, I just ended up making peace with the fact, I guess it just wasn't meant to be that I was going to continue at that high level career that I had in the beginning. It just wasn't meant to be. Not your night, kid, kind of thing.
But that was what you said to yourself then.
Yes. And I was so happy with my family, and I have my activism that I do with the United Nations for human trafficking. And so I cobbled together a really meaningful life for myself that I loved, and I still got to act. It just wasn't at that high visibility level. When I found out that Harvey had done that, that put me into a tailspin, because everything I had told myself for 17 years was, oh, wow, it wasn't just fate. It wasn't just, it wasn't my night, kid. There was an active, malevolent hand blocking my career completely, thwarting my ability to live out my dreams and to engage my talent, because I do have my own unique talent. I'm a sort of a strange actor, I think. Like I have interesting characters that I come up with, and and I love doing it, and I think I can be moving, and I can be funny, and I have my own gifts to give the world. And and he took that ability to give that away. And that is so, like, when people think of sexual harassment as not being that big of a deal, it is literally life shattering. Like, to take 20 years of my life in my given career, when I was an Oscar winner, man, I had a Golden Globe, I had Emmy nominations, I had other Golden Globe nominations, all of a sudden just gone off the landscape.
Because of that monster.
Because of a bad man that I would not sleep with. And he tried three different times, and the third time was right before the Lord of the Rings thing. So, you know, I just, that's something that people really need to understand, that harassment is not a small thing.
It An abuse literally, of power.
It took away my livelihood, my ability to feed my kids, and my ability to practice what I love, to, like, fulfill my own personal destiny. Like, I was meant to be an actress. I'm good at it. Like, it was proven that I was good at it.
Yeah.
And to be able to do that to me, imagine someone with less power in a smaller industry where they don't have any notoriety, they don't have any Oscar.
They're just trying to get by.
And some man is like, if you don't sleep with me, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to get you so no other company will hire you. I'm going to say that you did this. I'm going to, like, it is so evil. It is one of the most evil abuses of power that's out there. And it's as old as time, you know? So, I mean, I am proud to have been part of this generation that stood up and started to raise our voices together and make some collective change, you know, change legislation, change public opinions. But it was very hard for the first, like, year and a half after learning that. Like, I was in a bit of a tailspin because I was like, oh, my God, my life wasn't just sort of happening. It had been driven into that. It had been forced into that.
But at that point, like, I just watched that Bill Cosby doc. That the documentary, you know, we need to talk about Cosby and talking about survivors, that it seems like when there's this many, that everyone's isolated in their own experience until somebody, you know, says, like, that happened to you too.
Right. Yeah.
Now, did that happen right when you found out? How long did you have to sit alone with this?
I told everyone that I knew when he had first started making those advances, because they were physical. Yeah. It wasn't like with Ashley Judd where he just said, they talked about the possibility of having an affair.
Right.
He did stuff to me.
Yeah.
And I, you know, so I told my agents, I told my best friends, I told my publicists, my managers. No one was like, oh, that's illegal. You should go to the police, or you should have a lawsuit against him, or you should go to HR. Like, no one was like, you have a case, or that. They were all sort of like, oh, you know, just try and let it roll off your back, kind of like.
It's systemic apologists.
Yeah, like, just basically everybody knew it about him already, but I didn't know how extensive it was. I met one other person a year later when I was doing publicity for the Buccaneers, who told me a similar story. That was it for many years. And then I started seeing in the late aughts, there were articles supposedly brewing that they were going to expose him, and then they got squashed.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, you know, people are starting to know.
Yeah.
Or like Fabrizio, his pimp in Italy, you know, was like, you know, there were rumors, like, stuff was starting to come up, and he was so powerful, he would squash it.
Yeah.
I had no idea that there were so many of us. I had no idea. It was sort of stunning. Like, and, you know, they always want blood. But, like, I went on some New York talk show around that time, and they surprised me with a wall of images of like the 98 women that had come out so far. And they didn't tell me they were going to do it. And just seeing the preponderance of faces, and I just started crying. I was like, oh my God. Like, it was so overwhelming. And I have to say, some of the most lovely people I've ever met, I've met through this experience, and like gracious, incredible women. And most of them had their complete careers completely flattened. Like, can't work in the industry anymore. Don't work in the industry anymore. Do something completely different. Mm-hmm. They were all actors and now they're not. You know, one of them was a screenwriter, but also not working in the industry anymore. Mm. Like, everybody had to leave. So I am actually one of the very few lucky ones who did continue to work at a low level and now is finally being admitted back into those hallowed halls of good material, like, and with high-level people. Like, I can't tell you how much it means to be on the set of Shining Vale or something like Hollywood or Impeachment with Ryan Murphy, like working with these brilliant people in every department, all the other actors, the directors. I feel like, oh, I'm so happy. Like, I get to do my thing with people who are so terrific and the atmosphere is so positive and professional. And it's not like making some tiny indie where it's first time everybody and there's no commitment to quality. I mean, sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. Yeah. But like, there's that just run and gun. Like, we don't have the time. We don't have the money. We're not going to do it right. And here, everything's about doing it beautiful and amazing and creative. And I'm like, I'm so happy. Like, I'm literally like, like joyful.
Yeah.
And like working with people like Jeff Astroff is the best showrunner, the most loving person, and so funny on Shining Vale. And the fact that he was like, oh, you sing, you dance? Okay, I'm going to write that in for you. What? You know, like, you're making my dreams come true, you know? But it's like, yeah. I have to pinch myself because I was locked out of this situation for many, many, many years. And like, to see my name on a poster, like Courtney Cox, Greg Kinnear, Mira Sorvino, like, what? Like, I'm yeah. I'm in that conversation again, like where I'm one of the leads that you think you can hang it on on my name. Yeah. Like, it's so surprising to me. And I think I'm far more humble now, I think.
Also, like, everything's on the table. Like, you know, culture is shifting. Things have changed. It's transparent now who you are and what you came from. And the stigma of either, of the stigma of having Harvey ruining your career or the stigma of having talked is now behind you.
Yeah.
And because both of those seem to be sometimes problematic.
Yeah. I mean, I was very, very, very fortunate that speaking out did not end up further worsening my career. Actually, strangely, I think people gave me a fresh look because they're like, oh, what is the reason that we never consider her? Maybe we should consider her. Maybe it was all a pig spewing lies and destroying people's lives at will because that's what he did. Maybe there's nothing wrong with Mira. Let's give her an audition.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And those people who took those chances on me, those first chances, like, I mean, Startup. I don't know if you've seen the show Startup.
Yeah.
It was on Crackle. But it finally got discovered by the world when it went onto Netflix, and then it got to like number three in the whole world. Like, and I'm only in season three, but like those people taking a chance on me, they didn't need to do that.
Yeah.
And that was right in 2018, right after the Me Too stuff. Stuber, that was my first and only studio movie that I have done in 20 years. Okay. So that was right after that, you know?
Yeah.
And then Ryan Murphy casting me in Hollywood in a sort of life, art imitating life part of an aging actress who has been sort of unfairly kept down by a relationship with the studio head, although hers is consensual, not,
right,
you know, but there's still this imbalance of power. But there's this scene, I don't know if you've seen Hollywood, but there's a scene where I'm with Holland Taylor and Patti LuPone in the commissary, and they're telling me that they're going to give me this like really meaty part, and my character's been like B-movies forever, and she starts to cry with gratitude, like that I'm so grateful that you see me and what I might be capable of doing. And it was so meta, you know, it was so just like, well, this is me thanking Ryan Murphy for seeing me and knowing what I might be capable of doing, you know, and it was super moving for me, but also very vulnerable because it was like, well, everybody watching this is going to think about how this relates to Mira Sorvino, not just this character.
And how were those tears? Were those you were able to draw from your immediate situation?
Well, yeah, of course. It was, you know, having to hold trying to keep them in check, you know, rather than having to bring them up. There was no intentionality of like, you've got a crime here. It was like, so I don't know. So I'm in this new phase where I'm really grateful.
Yeah.
I'm aware that it could go away at any time.
But you're getting to do it.
I'm getting to do it. I'm getting to do what I love and what I think I was born for.
Yeah.
And so that's really special.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm all emotional. I'm happy for you.
Thank you.
And it was great talking to you, and this show is very entertaining, and it seems like you have other things going on. You can make movies?
I have all these indies that I keep doing, and they keep turning out surprisingly well. I did a movie called East of the Mountains, which is out right now, with Tom Skerritt in his first leading role in his whole career.
Oh, is that directed by, who directed that?
S.J. Chiro.
Yeah, I know her. She was like, S.J. Chiro, I know her. She was friends with my girlfriend who passed away, with Lynn Shelton. How was that?
It's terrific. And it's the only movie I've ever been in that has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, it's certified fresh, 100%.
Oh, my God.
Like, one single negative review.
I feel bad I haven't watched it yet.
Well, it's okay. I mean, it's like, settle down, you know, on one of these cold nights and watch it. And he gives such a great performance. And, you know, I play his daughter. And, you know, I don't have a very big part, but it's still emotionally important to the story. And he's so wonderful. And to think that a man of his stature and his talent never was the linchpin of a movie before, like himself. And
he's always 88. Around, though.
He's 88. You know, so he finally, you know, has his beautiful, you know, day in the sun. He's really wonderful and had so many accolades. It was too small of a movie, I think, to really get into Academy consideration, even though we tried.
Yeah.
But he did get, you know, nominated and honored by other, you know, awards and festivals. So that's still out right now. And then a movie today is opening up called Butter, which actually is also really terrific. It's directed by Paul Kaufman. And it's a very strange bird in that it's about a super serious topic, and yet it's a comedy. So it's about a boy, a teenage boy who is like morbidly obese, really, really, really heavy, like 400 pounds, who has this kind of Cyrano de Bergerac catfishing crush on this girl in his school, and he pretends to be somebody else online.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, he's being bullied really, really heavily, and everybody calls him Butter because they tried to force him to eat like a stick of butter. And so he decides that he's going to commit suicide online on New Year's Eve by eating himself to death. It's called Butter's Final Meal. He has this online plan. And oddly, because of it, he becomes popular. Like, all the cool kids, like, they can't even believe that he's doing this. And they, like, at first as a joke, start hanging out with him. And then they end up actually really liking him. And it's sort of about bullying. And it's about body shaming. And it's about suicide prevention. But it's a comedy.
Yeah.
And somehow it works.
What do you play?
I play his mom.
Oh, wow.
And his mom is very, like, she's very, it's like she's stuck kind of in this antiquated version of what a mom and a wife should be, and very feminine and always kind of babying him, kind of infantilizing him. And she makes him like smiley face pancakes. You know, she's always kind of forcing food on him, like food is love, even though he's obese. Got such a problem, a dangerous problem.
Yeah.
And as the story goes along, she really shifts and starts to understand how she can be there for him in a much healthier way. And it's very beautiful. It's really, I mean, it deftly weaves together like comedy and sort of teenage intrigue and then this real heartfelt growth. And you know, Paul Kaufman really wanted to do a movie that would kind of influence the national dialogue about suicide prevention in teens and body shaming and online bullying. And
that just opened today?
Today. So, it's gotten really wonderful reviews. So that's another one of these small movies that you do because you love, and then some of them turn out really great.
Well, like, that's great.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those ones, yeah.
So you're busy and back.
Yes, busy and back, and I really love Rosemary, my character in Shiny Vale, and you won't have seen that much of her yet if you've only seen the first few episodes, but as the season goes on, she becomes really crucial in it, and she's a very strange person because she's like, she is the dream of the former dead person. Like, Rosemary was a real person, 50s housewife, very repressed, kind of abused by her husband, just without hope, but she dreams of living like like a movie siren. Oh, so when you meet the ghost of Rosemary, she's fabulous. And she just wants to hold parties and let's drink, let's dance, let's go to Paris.
Yeah.
But there's also an evil side to her because she's a ghost, you know, so.
Oh, sure. But like, but was that your perception of the character or was that the backstory? Was it the device of the dream of that person your idea?
Well, I think it's sort of mine and sort of in the writing, but I definitely took her on this 50s silver screen, like, trajectory.
Yeah.
I mean, she's always in 50s clothes and she's from the 50s,
sure.
but like, I don't have her talk like a modern person. She's like, she's living her best life as she imagined life was supposed to be while she was alive and miserable. But she's kind of a combination. She's the real Rosemary is in there. The dead Rosemary is in there.
Yeah.
Then there's the spirit Rosemary, who is a much older entity, but also has hopes and dreams. And then there's also some, you know, like the scorpion, eventually she's going to sting you because she's, you know, a spirit in a house haunting.
Angry ghost.
Yeah, and there's things that happen. It's not so much that she's angry. She just, it's just in her nature. She has to cause mayhem. She has to cause destruction.
It's the ghost's responsibility.
It is.
And when they haunt a house.
Yes. And you know, the whole show is full of tips of the hat to other famous horror movies and, you know, like Rosemary's Baby, The Shining, Nightmare on Elm Street, Twin Peaks.
Well, now
like,
I'm going to watch the whole thing now.
Oh, you'll love it. It's really fun.
Oh,
it's really fun.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me.
Sure.
You feel good?
I do.
Okay. Okay. You okay? I hope she's okay. The show's fun, and it was great to talk to her. But it was like, it was, whew, yeah. The show she's on is Shining Veil. It's on Stars. Premieres this Sunday, March 6th. And, you know, go enjoy her and all her work. Okay. Guitar time. Les Paul time. Les Paul custom time.
Boomer lives. Monkey, LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.
Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season.
I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.